Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Now you're looking at a man that's getting kind of mad. I had lots of luck, but it's all been bad. No matter how I struggle and strive, I'll never get out of this world alive.
He never got out of this world alive, but Hank Williams' musical spirit lives on through his family. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and today, the story of three musical mavericks named Hank Williams. And later, you won't need to brush your teeth or iron your shirt for the type of date we're sending you on. It's our first Soundcheck blind date, and we're hoping you'll be smitten with a musician that we'll introduce you to. But let's start with Hank Williams, the king of the hillbillies, a title that he achieved and lost in a very short time span. By the time of his death at age 29, the country star had recorded more than 30 top 10 country singles, 11 of them number one hits. But Hank's legacy of musical talent and penchant for breaking the rules didn't die with him. It's been passed down through two additional generations of men named, yes, Hank Williams. Joining me now in the studio is Susan Massino, who recently wrote a book called Family Tradition, Three Generations of Hank Williams. Susan, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thanks, John. Thanks for having me here.
Family tradition sounds like such a great thing. And in the case of Hank Williams, it is both a great thing and a darker thing, it seems.
It is, yes, yes. He passed on a genius for songwriting, but he also passed on a weakness for a lot of things.
Like?
Alcohol, women, drugs, the celebrity.
So this king of the hillbillies was living the rock and roll lifestyle back in the late 40s, early 50s.
He was. He was the rock star of his time. I think that he recorded the first rock song when he did Move It On Over in 47.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of the way he kind of made his reputation off stage, he was kind of the punk rocker of his day as well.
He was a rock star. And my favorite story of him is one time he showed up for a gig. He didn't feel like playing at the time, so he walked up to the mic and said, "Y'all drove a long way to see old Hank, didn't ya?" And everybody cheered, and so he set his guitar down and said, "Now you saw him," and he turned around and left.
Wow. So this kind of darker side to Hank Williams has also, it seems, been passed down to Hank Williams Jr. and Hank Williams, Hank III, as
Hank
he's III. Known.
Yes, yes, very
right,
much so.
We can talk about each of them in turn, but let's hear all of them together. Tell me about this version of I'll Never Get Out of This World Alive. We were just hearing Hank's original.
Yes.
But they did a kind of Natalie Nat King Cole thing with this, didn't they?
Well, with There's a Tear in My Beer, Hank Jr. did that with Hank Sr. They spliced a video together and all of that. And then they also did an album called Three Hanks where Hank Jr. and Hank III sang along with Hank Sr. Mm-hmm. on about 10 songs.
So the full name of the record is Three Hanks, Men with Broken Hearts. And so this is Hank Jr. and Hank III singing along with their dad and grandfather, respectively.
Exactly.
On the song I'll Never Get Out of This World Alive.
My fishing pole's broke, the creek is full of sand. My woman run away with another man. No matter how struggle and strive, I'll never get out of this world alive.
My distant uncle passed away and left me.
Those are the Hank Williamses, Hank Williams Sr., Hank Williams Jr., and Hank III, Hank Williams III. All the voices through the magic of overdubbing in the same place at the same time. I'll Never Get Out of This World Alive. Susan Massino is author of the book Family Tradition, Three Generations of Hank Williams. Aside from the three voices on this one track, how much of a family relationship is there between the generations?
Well, that's kind of the sad story, because when Hank Sr. died, Hank Jr. was only 3, so he has very few memories of his father. And then when Hank Jr. and Gwen, his second wife, divorced, Hank 3 was only 3. So they both lost their fathers at the same age, and they really, even Hank Sr.'s father was hospitalized when Hank Sr. was 7, so they all grew up without a father.
Hmm. So this, you know, when we talk about this family tradition, kind of a musical genius, a tortured genius, and a proclivity to depression and alcohol and stuff, it's weird the way the kind of family dynamic repeats as well. The missing dad over 4 generations.
Absolutely. And now Hank III is breaking that cycle with his son Coleman, which is really great to see that.
All right. On that note, let's bring in Michael McCall. He is on the line with us. He's co-curator of the Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum exhibit, also called Family Tradition, subtitled The Williams Family Legacy. Michael, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So let's start with Hank Williams Sr. You know, he's had such an important role in the history of country music. How is he perceived, you know, within the halls of the Country Music Hall of Fame?
You know, I think he's the artist that everybody else has to measure themselves up against, you know, especially as a songwriter, especially when you think of, you know, how honest and how true your songs are to your own life. I think, you know, not every country singer tries to do that, but those who, you know, try to draw on their own experiences and put those into songs and make them have emotion and make them have sort of just a real direct poetic impact on people's lives. And no one's done it better since, you know, and so he's the, you know, sort of level that everybody shoots for.
And was that kind of songwriting really that different from what people had done before him? Did he represent a landmark change?
Right. Yeah, I think it was. It was a real huge shift in how songwriting could be taken. Because before that, you know, a lot of country music was very moralistic and, you know, dealt with tragedy and families and mothers. And there's, you know, honky-tonk writing had emerged and songs like Walking the Floor Over You with Ernest Tubb, but they weren't personal in the same way. I mean, I think you'd have to go back to Jimmy Rogers, who did have some personal songs.
Mm-hmm.
And he was sort of the first great country songwriter, and I think Hank was the second great one. And that's because they made it so, you know, that emotion was so real to them, and they conveyed that to the audience so strongly.
And so in 1949, a song like I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry, would this really have kind of shocked people with its sort of bare expression of emotion?
Well, I think it certainly touched them. You know, I think if you had a lot of men in that generation who didn't express their emotions very well, you know, as they're sort of coming out of World War II. And that's, you know, and I think Hank had a way of sort of opening his heart and expressing things for men and in the best ways that music can. And that's part of what made him so popular, is that he had that sort of ability to really tap into some very strong emotions.
The song is I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry from Hank Williams, said to be inspired by his relationship with his wife, Audrey.
Did you ever see a robin weep when leaves began to die? Like me, he's lost the will to live. I'm so lonesome I could cry. Silence of a falling star lights up a purple sky, and as I wonder where you are, I'm so lonesome I could cry.
First, the original Hank Williams, I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry, a hit for him in 1949. We are looking at the legacy of the Hank Williamses. Hank Williams Sr., Hank Williams Jr., Hank Williams III, or Hank III as he's known. Susan Massino's with me, author of the book Family Tradition, Three Generations of Hank Williams. We're also speaking on the line with Michael McCall, who was co-curator of the exhibit Family Tradition, the Williams Family Legacy at Nashville's Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum. And Michael, how did he get started? What were his first kind of rumblings of talent and fame?
You know, he was on the radio in his teens, even in 1937 in Montgomery, Alabama. But he wasn't that ambitious. He loved to play, you know, and he'd take any gig he could. He got kicked off the radio once or twice for the same reasons he had trouble later in life, for drinking and for not showing up. But he'd always get hired back because the fans loved him so much. But I think Audrey had a lot to do with the sort of pushing him a little bit. And
that's his wife,
trying
Audrey,
to get him to be a little more ambitious.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she wrote to Fred Rose in Nashville and sent him some songs, and a couple of those songs got cut by other artists. Molly O'Day cut one of his songs.
And, now, Fred Rose from the publishing firm of Acuff and Rose.
Acuff and Rose, yeah. And Fred Rose had been a 10-pan alley writer and was
right.
great. And a producer, you know, and he saw the talent in Hank and started working with him. But, he, you know, one of his first letters to Hank was he already had a reputation by then as a drinker. You know, we have a letter that Fred had written to Hank saying, you know, you've really got to get a control of this, you know. But he got him on the Louisiana Hayride, which is sort of the big move that sort of launched his career. And then later on to the Opry, so the Grand Ole Opry here in Nashville.
So the was this a turning point in his career, meeting Fred Rose? And
oh, yes, it was. It was a huge pivotal point for him because Rose wanted him at first just for his songwriting capabilities, but then they were looking for a singer, and he brought him back in to record, and it was a great partnership between the two of them.
Now, you mentioned before a song called Move It On Over, which is from 1947.
Yes.
So this is... You know, he's not quite at the cusp of his fame yet.
No, not
but
yet.
But you call this the first rock and roll song ever written.
I think it predates the 1951 Rocket 88, totally. If you listen to how they jam on that song, he rocked it. He rocked it out.
This is Hank Williams and the song Move It On Over.
Came in last night at 10:30. That baby of mine wouldn't let me in, so move it on over.
Move it on over.
Move it on over.
Move it on over.
Move over, little dog, cause the big dog's moving in. She's changed the lock on our front door. My door key don't fit no more, so get it on over.
Move it on over.
Scoot it on over.
Move it on over.
Move over, skinny dog, cause the fat dog's moving in. House here is mighty small, but it's better than no house at all. So ease it on over.
Move it on over.
Drag it on over.
Move it on over.
Move over, old dog, cause a new dog's moving in.
That is Hank Williams' 1947 song, Move It On Over. And if it wasn't the first rock and roll song then, it certainly has become a rock and roll song, Susan, now.
I mean, it's been covered by a lot of
artists. So many people, yes. George Thorogood and the Destroyers. And Susan Massino's here with me in the studio. Michael McCall with us on the line. Susan wrote the book Family Tradition. Mike McCall co-curating the exhibit called Family Tradition, looking at the Hank Williams legacy. Michael, that was a 1947 song, but at a certain point, Hank Williams begins to have number one hits.
And Move It On Over was a number four song, so it was a country hit.
Mm-hmm.
Also, if you listen, you can tell it's an exact note-to-note arrangement that Bill Haley used for Rock Around the Clock. So, you know, it's just considered one of the early rock and roll songs, too. So he certainly had an influence on rock and roll, and I think it is the first rock and roll song. It's exactly the same song. So.
Mm-hmm. Now, how did this play in the country music? I mean, at the Grand Ole Opry and places like that, was he a welcome figure?
Yeah, he was. You know, of course, he'd had his issues as time went on. But when his first performance at the Opry, he had six encores, they say. You know, they kept calling him back, and he kept singing Lovesick Blues over and over because the crowd went crazy. And you could see, you know, the letters and the Opry attendance, and you know, it was always full, but the lines got a lot longer. And you know, Hank, he was such a big star, and that's I think part of the, when you say a rock and roll star, he had a charisma that very few country stars had at the time. And he dressed a little differently. You know, he's a little sharp dressed guy, you know, that Audrey kind of had him in suits and things, where a lot of country stars had dressed down as more of a hillbilly fashion until him, you know. So he had an effect somewhat on even how they looked, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I love the idea of people just calling him out again and again because of this song, The Lovesick Blues by Hank Williams.
I got a feeling called the blues, oh Lord, since my baby said goodbye. Lord, I don't know what I'll do. All I do is sit and sigh. Oh Lord, that last long day she said goodbye. Well, Lord, I thought I would cry. She'll do me, she'll do you. She's got that kind of loving. Lord, I love to hear her when she called me sweet. Daddy, such a beautiful dream. I hate to think it all over.
Lovesick Blues from Hank Williams, 1949 hit song for him, one of many that he had during an all-too-brief life. Susan, we've all mentioned alcohol abuse. Mm-hmm. The fact is he was born with a spina bifida.
Exactly,
So he was often in a lot of pain.
He was, even as a teenager. Mm-hmm. He had back problems. One of the first songs he ever wrote was Backache Blues.
So he would kind of self-medicate with painkillers, with morphine eventually, with alcohol
as
well.
He did later on. He self-medicated, I believe, with alcohol until he ran into a gentleman that started giving him a drug called Coral Hydrate, which was a hugely dangerous sedative. And that was, you know, the turning point of him losing his life.
Coral Hydrate.
They used to use it in Mickey Finn's.
Yeah, and that is intimated to have been involved in his death, right?
Yes. He met a guy that he called himself a doctor, Toby Marshall. He was not a real doctor. And he started prescribing
Coral
Hydrate.
Did Hank know that?
I don't believe Hank knew at the time that he wasn't a real doctor.
So he's taken this stuff. He's going from a canceled New Year's Eve gig in, I guess it was West Virginia, to
up to Canton, Ohio.
Ohio for his New Year's Day gig.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got a college student driving him in the back of a car.
A car, exactly.
And somewhere along the way, he passes away.
Well, you know, what's really interesting when you study the time they spent in Knoxville, they got up to Knoxville and they realized they weren't going to make the gig unless they flew. So they got on a 3 o'clock flight, took off out of Knoxville, and because of the snowstorm, they actually got turned around and got back to Knoxville by 6. By 7 o'clock, they're in a hotel room, and they're giving, they call in a doctor for Hank, and he received 2 shots of morphine.
Mm-hmm.
And when they put him into the car to travel to Canton, Ohio, he was already unconscious.
Michael, there's a bit of controversy about Hank Williams' death, right? Like
where
it took place and exactly how and all that kind of stuff.
Right. Yeah, there have been even some books that said he may have been dead when they carried him out in Knoxville. But we've talked to one of the hotel employees who's still alive, who was one of the people who carried him out, and said he was definitely still semi-conscious and sometimes breathing. You know, they could hear him breathing. They could hear him moaning even, you know, that he was, you know, moaning in a way that, you know, somebody who's stoned or drunk can moan when they're out. But so they could, you know, put him in the back seat of the Cadillac. They don't know at what point he, you know, there's some controversy as to when he may have passed away and when the driver may have, you know, freaked out about it and not known what to do. So there's some questions about that, but it certainly happened in the car someplace.
Well, that is part of the legacy of Hank Williams, and we've been discussing the first part of that legacy so far. We'll continue our conversation about the three musical mavericks named Hank Williams with Hank Williams Jr. and Hank III in just a moment. And join us for our next event in WNYC's Green Space. We'll welcome 4 great artists as part of Soundcheck's Mic Check, our showcase of local hip-hop. Catch sets from new stars like The Freeze Tag and Nitty Scott MC, plus 2 underground heroes, Queens MC Homeboy Sandman, and this Brooklyn-based rapper and drummer, Blitz the Ambassador, with his 7-piece band. It's all taking place in the Green Space on June 9th at 8 p.m. For tickets, go to wnyc.org/thegreenspace.
Raise the rap music, scared of their own voice. That's why they auto-tune it. Same force, tack it up and clap. Then it's God, the God clap for the blasphemy. Word to Chuck Berry.
Not everybody loves me, but those that do will fight. Right to the end, they're guitar friends from legendary Saturday Night. I learned something from Lynyrd Skynyrd, from my daddy and Ernest Tubb, too.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. We've been talking about the legacy of Hank Williams Sr., which not only lives on through his own music, but also through the music of his son, whom you're hearing now, Hank Williams Jr., and his grandson, Hank Williams III. Joining me once again, Susan Massino, author of Family Tradition, Three Generations of Hank Williams, and Michael McCall, who curates the exhibit known as Family Tradition, The Williams Family Legacy at Nashville's Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum. Michael, Hank Jr. has also had an unusual career and started it in the considerable shadow of his dad.
He certainly did.
So he was kind of seen as a Hank Williams imitator at first, right?
Yeah, not just seeing him purposely, as his mother put him on the road singing his dad's songs, you know, as he first performed him at eight. And by the time he was in his early teens, he was, you know, on Ed Sullivan's show, I think at age 14, singing one of Hank's songs. So he's, you know, he spent several years where that was what he was known for, was he was going out and singing his dad's songs. And it, for a while, I think, you know, made him famous and got him some hits on the radio, but eventually it became, you know, something you needed to shed, you
right,
know, to be an
right.
artist for himself. So.
Well, this is young Hank Jr. on the Ed Sullivan Show, 1963, and his dad's song, Your Cheatin' Heart.
Hank Williams Jr., the 14-year-old son, to sing some of his dad's country music hits. So let's have a fine welcome for this show.
Your cheatin' heart.
Hank Williams Jr. on the Ed Sullivan Show in 1963. Susan, that's a remarkable voice to come out of a 14-year-old boy, no matter who his father was.
No matter who he is. And what's really cool is that Your Cheatin' Heart, the movie, came out in 65, I believe, and Hank Jr. at 15 years old sings that soundtrack that sold over a million copies. And you don't think you're listening to a boy sing at all. It sounds like his father.
So, as Michael said, you know, that was a great thing to start his career, but then it becomes like a millstone around his neck. How does he finally shed that?
Oh, my gosh. He went through so much. I mean, he did that until he got of age and broke away from his mother and her management. He wanted to play rock and roll. He loved rock and roll. But he moved out in Nashville. He went down to Alabama and started to record Muscle Shoals studio. He loved the Allman Brothers, the Marshall Tucker Band, and he wanted
Charlie
to...
Charlie Daniels, we heard
exactly.
him mention Lynyrd Skynyrd in that song we heard before.
And he wanted to be part of that, and so he did a new album called, you know, Hank Jr. and Hank Williams Jr. and Friends, and went on a trip to kind of get ready to go back on tour. He was going through a divorce. He was fighting drug and alcohol addiction. He was trying to, you know, shed his father's shadow. Mm-hmm. And then he went mountain climbing and fell off a mountain 442 feet.
And instead of dying somehow with his cranium essentially split open, survives...
Yes.
And hence the beard and the sunglasses that have become his trademark, right?
Exactly.
To cover the scars from
yes.
the surgery.
Yes, I mean, he shattered every bone in his head.
That was 1975.
Yes.
So this is Hank Williams Jr., who to this day is probably best known through much of the country for the Monday Night Football theme
exactly.
song
yes.
that he did, that he recorded, and which I think won him a couple of, like, Emmy Awards.
He's gotten four.
Yeah. This is Hank Williams Jr., 1975, just before the accident called Stoned at the Jukebox.
Friends around me, oh, it helps to keep a worried mind occupied. I do all right till dark of night surrounds me, and then I think of her, and then I cry.
Hank Williams Jr. from his 1975 pre-accident album, Stoned at the Jukebox, the album called Hank Williams Jr. and Friends, which featured a lot of, Susan, those bands you were talking about before, members
yes.
of Marshall Tucker's band, Charlie Daniels, etc.
Exactly, a couple Allman Brothers guys, yeah.
Now, yep. You mentioned that he really wanted to do rock, and of mm-hmm. course, as a kid and through circumstance, was sort of forced into the country thing. Let me bring Michael back in here as well from Nashville. Michael, it seems that maybe he learned a lesson in kind of staying out of his own son's way, because Hank III has definitely gone the rock route, hasn't he?
Yes, they have. And if you look at it, they both, Hank Jr. and Hank III, kind of took the hip music of their time. You know, with Hank Jr., he took Southern rock and electric blues, which was, you know, real cool in the early, mid-70s. And merged that a bit with country music and kind of came up with his own sound. And he sang very much about his own life, like, as his father had. And then Hank III, of course, you know, comes up in another generation when he's listening to metal and punk and thrash music and also listening to sort of the coolest aspect of country music, which is the honky-tonk,
mm-hmm.
and which is a little bit anti-Nashville in its sense, you know. And he merged all those into sort of a signature sound that's unlike anybody else as well. So they each kind of took something, you know, of their time and merged it with their own legacy, and came up with something really powerful and unique. Yes.
And we can hear a little bit of Hank III, but Susan, we can't on the radio show people what he looks like. What does he look like?
He looks just like his grandfather. he really does.
Looks exactly like the first Hank Williams, but this does not sound like that Hank Williams. No, he's not singing Hillbilly. He's singing Hellbilly. That is Hank Williams III. Hank III, as he's known. And the third of a generation of singer-songwriters in the Williams family. Michael McCall co-curates the exhibit at Nashville's Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum called Family Tradition, the Williams Family Legacy. Michael, at the end of the day, what is the legacy of the Williams family?
Yeah, I think it's to write about yourself, to find a way of in a very charismatic but direct, unfiltered way to say, this is my life, you know, these are the issues I'm dealing with, this is sort of a poetic way of putting it out there, and people respond really strongly to that.
And Susan Massino, author of Family Tradition, Three Generations of Hank Williams, you mentioned before that Hank III might be finally breaking the repeating cycle of absentee fathers?
Yes, he's gotten close to his son Coleman.
They had been estranged for a number of years.
He
so
didn't
it seemed
even know.
Like
yeah, he didn't even know about him till he was 2 and a half. But once he was older, he reunited, and he consciously is trying to break that cycle and be there for his son.
Hopefully without breaking the musical cycle that seems to go along with the darker side of the Williams family tradition. We've been speaking with Susan Massino and Michael McCall. Susan, Michael, thank you both for being with us on Soundcheck today.
You bet, John. It's a pleasure.
Thanks, John. Thanks for having me.
Up next, our first ever Soundcheck Blind Date series aims to make a musical love connection between you, the listener, and a debuting artist. That's next.
But when I get a kiss, I think that something's wrong. I'm leaving now. I'm leaving now. I'm a long gone daddy. I don't need you anyhow. I'll go find a gal that wants to treat me right. You go get yourself a man that wants to fight. I'm leaving.